Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Today we're talking about solutions to the climate crisis. We know our climate is changing from warming temperatures to more frequent and fierce hurricanes, floods, and droughts. We know that climate changes are due largely to greenhouse gases, especially carbon, being released in the atmosphere, particularly from the burning of fossil fuels like coal and oil. What we need to know is what can we do about it? Our guest today has a plan for what we can do about the climate crisis. Dr. Arjun Makhijani is a scientist. He spoke with us a few years ago about his book called Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, A Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. It was the first analysis of a transition to a U.S. economy based completely on renewable energy without any use of fossil fuel or nuclear power. His latest book shows how one state can respond to the climate crisis. The book is called Prosperous Renewable Maryland, Roadmap for a Healthy, Economical, and Equitable Energy Future. Since publishing that book, he has built on that plan to say what we could do nationally about the climate crisis. Dr. Makhijani earned a PhD in nuclear fusion in electrical engineering from the University of California at Berkeley, and is the founder of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research in Tacoma Park, Maryland. He's been a friend and colleague of mine for years, and for a time I served on the board of his institute. Dr. Makhijani, welcome back to All Together Now.
Well, thank you, Eleanor. Good to be back on your show.
So to start off, for those who might have missed it, but to get your assessment, how dangerous is global warming? And do you think it's, you know, is that what's impacting our generation, not just our children?
Well, you know, it's not really about the average temperature change. I have long told people that it's the head in the oven and feet in the freezer, and the average temperature is 1 degree more. It's the head in the oven and feet in the freezer that determines your discomfort. That's what we're going through. If you look at the Arctic, how much it has heated. So now we have severe climate disruption. And if you look at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports, now these are consensus reports, you know, they're partly political and so on. So the actual, in my opinion, the reality on the ground is evolving sort of worse than depicted in those reports. But even if you just look at the most recent report from about 2 years ago, at 2 degrees Celsius average temperature rise, that's about almost 4 degrees Fahrenheit, 99%+ of coral reefs would be destroyed. Even at 1.5 degrees Celsius, 70% of coral reefs would be destroyed. Now, these hundreds of millions of people depend on their livelihoods for coral reefs. These are among the most biodiverse places on the planet. They're very important to the global ecosystem. So I think, you know, we're not yet recognizing how much we depend on the global ecosystem for our survival. And that's just one example. You know, the fires, the droughts, the floods. I'll give you one more example. In 2017, the extreme climate events in the United States alone, costing more than $1 billion per event, the total damage from that was more than $300 billion.
Wow.
Almost $1,000 for every man, woman, and child in the United States. So, and you know, that's not every year, fortunately, but more frequent. And when insurance companies start backing out, as they are in many areas, you know, we can have an economic crisis. I don't know how sudden it's going to be. One hopes that it won't be as sudden as the COVID crisis has overtaken us, but it could come suddenly and sharply. Mm-hmm. And we're not preparing either to reduce emissions or to adapt and become more resilient. And we need to do both. Sorry for the long answer, but.
No, that's, we need to know kind of where we stand. And it seems to be an increasingly grim picture. I mean, you've been on the show a couple of times, and every time you've been here, the report on where we're at is more and more grim. And it seems like the window is closing. I know there's the international report saying we basically have a 10-year window to seriously stop greenhouse gas emissions, or we're going to hit a point of no return. And so we need to do everything we can do now to stop those greenhouse gas emissions. I know you were invited to give testimony to Congress last fall. Could you share with our listeners, like, what goals do you think the U.S. needs to set to deal effectively with this climate crisis?
Well, you know, I submitted the testimony as part of an open invitation from the Select Committee on Energy and Climate, based on my work, as you said, Prosperous Renewable Maryland, and trying to extend that to the national stage. I think, you know, there are four big sectors in the economy that use fossil fuels and have large carbon dioxide and methane emissions. And I'll leave agriculture aside for the moment. We can come back to that. They're the transportation sector, they're the electricity sector, and the residential and commercial building sector, and the industrial sector. And we need to set targets in each one of these. The big target has to be that the United States should eliminate essentially all fossil fuel use by the mid-2040s at the latest. And to accomplish that, you need a completely renewable electricity sector by 2040 or so, because a lot of the reduction in emissions depends on electrification of transportation, electrification of heating in buildings where we use natural gas and oil and propane quite a bit, and making everything more efficient. So there's the building sector where we need to electrify. There's the transportation sector where we need to electrify. We can't electrify the whole transportation sector yet. You know, there's aircraft. Ships, we're making rapid progress in ships, which was not that much on the horizon even 2-3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And even electric aircraft, small ones, are now being flown on a, you know, trial basis. We need to also, we need to clean up the electricity sector faster than the whole economy so it can enable all these transitions. And in the industrial sector, which is quite hard, I think we need to replace a lot of natural gas use by electrolytic hydrogen from renewable energy. We need to make it a lot more efficient. And, you know, when we eliminate petroleum use, a lot of the industrial energy use will go away, because a surprising amount of it is actually in oil refining. And you know, taking the crude oil and converting it into gasoline and diesel and fuel oil and so on.
So it's not just the burning of the fossil fuels, it's the production of them is creating these greenhouse gas emissions too.
So there are a couple of other areas of industrial energy use that and emissions that I'd like to call to your attention, because some of the big solutions and economic opportunities actually lie there. One is in nitrogen fertilizer production. A very large amount of natural gas is used as raw material for fertilizer production, and also for plastics and synthetics production. And so the big opportunity there is we can go to natural materials. Of course, we can all also economize, and that's a big part of my solution. We can come to that later. And then a very, very big part of global CO2 emissions is cement production. And most people are not aware of that from the use of limestone and also from the use of coal and gas in cement production. So we need to find good substitutes for cement and reduce emissions from the cement sector. But I just want to call attention that most people aren't focused on cement. but it's a very, very, very big issue.
That's great. And I know, you know, I want to come back and we'll go into a little bit more of the details on your wonderful plan for what to do here. But I found it interesting that there's been so much technological progress in the past, even 5 or 10 years, that has made renewable energies as kind of the go-to clean, green energy to replace all these fossil fuel, that there's been almost, really dramatic increases in the technological ability and reductions in costs for the renewable energy we need to replace the fossil fuels. Can you talk a little bit about the promise of some of these new technologies and what's happened already?
Yeah, when I wrote the first assessment, Carbon Free, Nuclear Free, in 2007, I thought the road to a renewable emissions-free energy economy would be very, very hard, but doable. Solar cells were very expensive. Batteries were extremely expensive. It seemed we might need a lot of biofuels, which take a lot of land. So it looked very complicated and difficult. Mm-hmm. By the middle of this, the middle of the teens decade, 2015, 16, 17, it had become clear that renewable energy is going to be cheap. And today, as we are talking on this program, for a year or two, by Wall Street's analysis, the Wall Street firm Lazard issues an annual analysis of electricity use and also storage. By Wall Street's analysis, the cheapest new electricity sources are wind and solar. Onshore wind and solar, and even offshore wind, which was quite expensive until about 2 years ago, has dramatically come down in cost. I mean, dramatically. It was like $120, $130, $150 a megawatt hour just 3 years ago or four. Today in Europe, where they have a lot of offshore wind, it is $50 and $60 a megawatt hour. That's just in 3 years. So it's very dramatic. And similarly, the costs of batteries, both for automotive and electricity storage purposes, have declined from $1,000 a kilowatt hour to a couple hundred dollars, and they're going down pretty rapidly. And so I think the technological landscape is such that I can confidently say that we will actually have save money by accelerating the transition to renewable energy. And if we do the storage and smart grid pieces right, we will have a more resilient system, something that's much less vulnerable to fires and floods and disruptions. We can accomplish that. Not the kind of thing that happened, for instance, in New York City when Hurricane Sandy hit in 2012. And everybody paid attention because Wall Street had a blackout for a week. And so we can prevent against that, actually, by looking at the example of what Wall Street has been doing since for themselves. So the short of it is now a transition to a renewable energy economy, except for these corners like aircraft, can be faster. And it is the most economical way to proceed. There are some obstacles, but they're not technical or economic obstacles. Obviously, there are obstacles. We're not proceeding at the required speed.
That's very encouraging.
It is. Technological landscape is very, very encouraging. My crystal ball on this is very clear now, and I come from the land of crystal balls, so.
That's great. We get our three wishes from the genie. What you're saying is really so important. It was a big obstacle for a while. People were like, I want to go renewable, but that's going to cost me so much more in electric costs. So, I don't want to go there, or willing to, but you got to pay out, through the nose for it. But now I talked to a mayor in a town in Texas who is he's a Republican, and he shifted his town to be renewable. And I said to him, why did you do it? He wasn't persuaded by all the arguments about the terrible climate and this and that. He said it was a straight economic decision. It was cheaper to go to solar and wind, the renewable energy sources, and he wanted to save money for his city there. So he went to renewable energy and he's saving a ton of money. So the hope, I think, has been when we could get that technological progress to the point where the costs drop, then you have an economic imperative to move that way, which joins with what we know is also the climate imperative. Like, we want to stop these extreme weathers and potential collapse of our economic system. So I think that is extremely encouraging. So speaking of the land of crystal balls and the three wishes from the genie, if you were advising the president and you could say, here's the top three things that we need to be doing right now to deal with this climate crisis, what are the top three wishes?
Let me take my cue from the mayor. So, you know, a dozen years ago, you know, we were thinking you have to have a carbon tax, you have to have a carbon price, you know, you have to. Right now, we don't need any of that. We don't need to price carbon and so on to make renewables more competitive. Renewables are already the most competitive energy source, period. We can address the question of variability in solar and wind. All that technology is also here. So my message is, a big picture message, is right now going to renewables is both pro-business and pro-environment. Mm-hmm. My calculations done over many years, very carefully, every single element, is that if energy overall, energy services, you know, the cooling and the heating and the driving and so on, is cheaper, that's not only good for households because it makes your energy costs cheaper, it's also very good for business. A lot, because, you know, energy costs are a big part of the bills of business. You know, it's rent and utilities, just like in your home. So, you know, there are also personnel costs, of course. I mean, you look at the fuel costs of driving around in companies that have large fleets of cars, and an electric car costs 3 cents a mile to drive it, and gasoline, you know, depending on the vehicle you have, it could cost 9, 10, 12, 14, 15 cents a mile to drive. And that's just the fuel costs. Maintenance costs are also lower. So my message is that don't worry about the carbon, just do the economical thing, and we will have huge amounts of environmental benefits and huge amounts of economic benefits, and the carbon dioxide reduction is free. So that's the first message. The second is we have to completely make the electricity sector 100% renewable by 2040 at the latest. And within that, we should make sure that we have sufficient decentralized solar power with storage, so that when the grid goes down, when there are fires and so on, that we have these microgrids that can provide emergency services, that can keep the grocery stores and so on going, so that we don't have the kind of breakdowns that we had in extreme weather events. So going to renewables has to be done in a way that looks to adaptation to climate extremes also. And we can do that because now, you know, we have distributed solar being quite economical and storage also quite economical. So there's a kind of an electricity sector, brothers. There's a transportation sector, brothers. I'm just talking the technical wish list. Mm-hmm. We should ban the sale of petroleum cars by 2035 at the latest. Mm-hmm. I think 2030 would be better. And in order to encourage that, I think the federal, state, and local governments should buy only zero emission vehicles, electric cars primarily, or, you know, for long distance vehicles, if electric cars are not suitable, then cars that run on fuel cells with renewable hydrogen. So I think the government purchases kind of stimulates the market, provides incentives for or investment by manufacturers and the infrastructure. And of course, we need to build the necessary infrastructure. Range for vehicles is not an issue anymore. The first cost is still somewhat an issue, but I think that issue will disappear in a couple of years, 3 years. We're still in the early stages of the electric vehicle transition. But I think if the first place to transform is the large mileage vehicles. So government should give incentives, but not incentives to upper middle class and wealthy people to buy electric cars. I think the incentive should be given to like taxi drivers, bus fleets, school buses, vehicles that do a lot of miles, and that vehicles that can also be where the batteries in the vehicle can also be used during the appropriate times for storage for electricity. It's called vehicle to grid technology. Your vehicle is parked, it's connected to the grid. It charges from the grid and can also supply electricity to the grid. When you go to the airport, you park your vehicle, you plug it in, and you get paid to park.
Because
if you have vehicle to grid, and then you park in the long-term parking at Baltimore Washington Airport, there are 10,000 long-term parking spots. It's like that's like a very big power plant. And then the grid can use your car for meeting needs when there's not enough wind and solar, and then recharge your car, and then you can set it so there'll be a minimum charge so you can drive home when you get back. So that gives you an example of the kind of technology we already have and how we can overcome. So a lot of people say, what are you going to do when the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow? Well, I know the sun doesn't shine at night. It's the definition of night, sun not shining. I know the wind blows sometimes, it doesn't blow other times. And that, you know, as an electrical engineer, the first thing about electricity has to be the light's got to come on when you flip the switch.
Right.
The second thing has to be the bill has to be reasonable. So is what you're proposing, does what you're proposing meet these two fundamental criteria? And if it doesn't meet the fundamental criteria, then you can't make it happen. But what I'm proposing not only meets those fundamental criteria, it meets it better and more reliably and in a more resilient way than what we have now. It doesn't mean the transition is going to be you can have the same transmission and grid. We got to make a transformation, but we can do it if we want. So what's holding it up?
Right.
So my third big wish would be in the industrial and materials arena. We need, so we've had an energy technical revolution, although we're not using it the way we should. We need a materials revolution. 50 years ago, I started the first efficiency study that was ever done when I was a graduate student at Berkeley. We need something similar on materials. We don't talk about steel efficiency and cement efficiency. We don't talk about renewable cement. You can make cement, you can make hempcrete. So you can use agricultural materials to make structural materials. You know, your furniture is a carbon, your wood furniture is kind of a carbon storage. Buildings can become carbon storage. But we have to grow these materials in a way that makes sense for the soil and for agriculture and is compatible with food production. There's a whole revolution in sustainable materials that need to happen. And so rather than a technical target, I would say we need an institution for materials and agricultural sustainability in the same way that we have an institution for like the National Renewable Energy Lab, which has done brilliant work for the last 40 plus years. We need more urgently a materials revolution and an institution like that that's dedicated. So that's my wish list of three.
That's great. Well, as the genie, I grant that all your wishes will come true.
You want me to bring my lamp up? I have an oil lamp.
It's oh, fantastic.
Beautiful. It's from France, actually.
Oh, of course. So I want to come back to exactly how we do it, given, you know, if the magic lamp doesn't work instantly today, like what actually we can do and what is already in progress. But before we get there, you mentioned the importance of electrification for the vehicles and everything else. And one of the problems right now, like my husband and I are thinking about buying another car and, you know, thinking about electric, but then you look around going, well, where would we charge it? And I know you lived for a while, worked in Tacoma Park, Maryland, which has the first gas station or former gas station in the United States that's converted 100% to charging for electric vehicles. But they're few and far between. And it's kind of sad because I did work for Boston Edison. I led a team on moving towards greater energy efficiency. And I was reading about the history of energy. And with the very beginning with Thomas Edison, he wanted to electrify cars. He, in fact, had set up electricity charging stations for people to charge their cars with electricity. But those all got ripped out because there was a push by the petroleum industry and the tires industry to push the fossil fuel cars run by gasoline. So we had it and kind of got ripped out. But consequently, here we are now, 2020, and yeah, we don't really have much infrastructure for charging our cars. How hard would it be to add electricity recharging to current gas stations or just replacing them entirely?
So these are teething troubles of the transition. So once electric cars have 250, 300 plus mile ranges, the charging problem becomes less acute automatically. Mm-hmm. Because most driving is for short trips. You go to work, you go to the grocery store, and so on. On the longer trips, quick charging stations are already available on the interstates. You know, you stop for coffee or go to the bathroom and, you know, you plug in your car for 15 minutes and, you know, you got another 100, 150 miles of range. And that's with today's technology. So the fast charging technology will improve with the next generation of batteries. Remember, we're still sort of in the first generation of the battery revolution, lithium ion batteries, which have enabled us to get to this point. But the next generation of solid state lithium batteries, for example, would be very different, charge much faster, be more reliable, no risk fires, all of that. For the moment, I would say, if you have a carport or a garage or an outlet, you know, where at your house where you can charge, and you buy a car with adequate range, I would say 250 miles or more, or 200 miles or more, you shouldn't have a problem because most of you can just charge at home, except when you're on longer trips where you can charge, you know, by main stop for 3 minutes. Now, at my age, you know, I always stop up there under 30 minutes. So it's not a problem. But for people who are more in a hurry, for, you know, people who drive trucks professionally, every time is more important, those problems still are. Sufficiency of charging infrastructure is very important. And I think for new construction, we should have construction specifications that new construction should automatically include car charging. You know, the simplest level or slowest level of car charging. The bigger problem comes in with the multifamily apartment buildings. Mm. And so here, you know, whether you're going to buildings that have garages would be less difficult, but you do have to make an investment in the distribution system so the wires can carry the current. So I said that the technology is here and it will be cheaper if we do it, but the big obstacle is we need to think differently about the energy system. We need to connect the production of energy with the use of energy more intimately. I talked about resilience and microgrids. This is actually a very, very big example Right now, we just build buildings, and you know, the utility provides the wires, and somewhere the electrons are coming. It's like, you know, going to the grocery store and thinking food grows in the grocery store, and electricity comes out of the plug. Well, now we know in the crisis that food doesn't grow in the grocery store, but actually farmers and farmers markets. And so that's been a sort of mentally salutary thing for those of us who are urban types. I was already pretty aware of that, you know, having lived in rural areas for some time. But we need to have a similar consciousness about electricity. It doesn't come out of the plug, you know. Mine comes off of my rooftop for the most part, but I exchange electricity with the grid. I export and import with the grid. But we need to design the whole system, not just the technical part. How do utilities get compensated for the grid? Right now, we pay them for the amount of electricity they sell us. But now they sell me less electricity this year than 10, 12 years ago or 20 years ago. And so how are they going to get compensated to invest in the wires? And so there's a whole kind of economic regulatory revolution that needs to happen within the weeds, the regulators, the electrical engineers, the Institute for Electronic and Electrical Engineers, to which I belong. They're all thinking about how this transition is going to work economically, and the car charging piece of it is one, but it's very important to have new construction regulations and also to invest in infrastructure for those who use vehicles in their businesses. That, I think, is most important. We're not focusing enough on that. We're too focused on, you know, having your Tesla or your electric Volkswagen or whatever you want, which is all to the good. I'm not against it, but I think we need to focus much more, and first of all, where the transportation market connects with people's livelihood.
No, exactly right. I'm afraid, and if you're going to start, we tend to think about these individual solutions being in the United States, like you're talking about the individual electric cars, and that's good. But I think you're right. Let's think like big scale, how do we get the most bang for our buck the fastest? And if you can look at things like public transit and the school buses, where you're having a lot of people use the buses and the trains, and if we can electrify all that, like, let's start there and just rapidly cut the carbon emissions and whatnot, the fossil fuel use, through that, as well as the individuals buying the electric cars. So
you know,
I think
Go
ahead.
You know, this particular crisis has created a huge new opportunity for something that many people have been wanting, that is actually being implemented, especially in some cities in Europe, I think led by Paris. So since there's now very little traffic and people are reluctant to get on public transport, you know, cities like Paris and other cities in Europe, I'm not aware if major U.S. cities are doing it. I think Oakland has done shut off streets to cars, or large parts of streets to cars. And now we can have basically a pedestrian lane, a lane for bicycles and electric scooters, and a lane for public transport. And if that is the basic road infrastructure, actually, you know, a lot of people can commute by electric bicycles much or most of the year if there is a safe infrastructure. Now, what's happening in Paris is people are taking to their bikes much more. Bike sales have skyrocketed. The government is subsidizing repairs of old bicycles, so that business is booming. And people who normally wouldn't think of taking a bike to commute are doing it because it is safer. You know, bicycle riders have a lot of courage in the present situation. And that's one of the reasons I, you know, right now, you know, I don't know if I would do it now at my age, but it's one of the reasons I hesitated to use the bicycle even when I was young, even though I commuted to the university often on my bicycle. But it was always with some hesitation. So we can, if we can change the infrastructure of the cities to accommodate these new technologies that have come along that are very economical for materials, for energy, and also provide us with exercise and health, I think we should seize the moment and do that. At least try it experimentally. I know, you know, if you live in an apartment building, how can you get your building in your car and where you are parked? So it's not a simple transition. It will require design and thinking, but this is the time to seize the moment, and many cities are doing it.
Fantastic. Yeah, I love it. And it's not just Paris. It's throughout the United States, more people are taking to bikes to get around. You're exactly right. Like, I would never ride a bike in the streets of DC because the traffic is so bad and there's bike lanes are so insufficient. It's been really dangerous. But now there's so few cars out there. You go, yes, the bikes and the birds have taken over our streets.
Wonderful. But I think they have to be made systematically safe.
Right.
So the bike lanes actually have to have separate, physically separate lanes with barriers between the bike lanes. And there have to be bike lanes in each direction. So it's going to take a lot of the road space that is now occupied by cars. And a big, big advantage of that is that it can make the transportation transition less difficult, less expensive, and fast.
Yeah. Well, now back to the three wishes. In case the genie falls flat, how do we make these great plans come to implementation? And I know you've mentioned about how we've made tremendous technological progress. There's no technological barrier now to moving towards 100% renewable energy rapidly. There's no technological barrier to electrification, including of vehicles. So the biggest barrier seems to be the political one of moving Congress and the president and state legislators to some extent to actually move this way. And we know the fossil fuel industry and even the nuclear industry has paid enormous amounts in lobbying and supports of candidates and elected officials to really block climate action and push the fossil fuel subsidies that they're making. So that seems to be our biggest obstacle here. And I'm so encouraged to see the big movement towards a climate action with the Sunrise Movement, the young people rising up going, hey, we want a future. We want to be able to breathe when we grow up. We want a planet when we grow up. And really, we're making some great gains. We kind of got pushed a little to the side burner here with the pandemic and with the rightful movement for the racial justice with our police system. But still, the climate crisis goes on as we deal with the pandemic and racial justice. So what's your sense of who's out there that's doing the best work to try and implement some of these great ideas?
Well, let me talk about the obstacles. So there's not a technical obstacle now or an economic obstacle in principle, but the fossil fuel industry is very big and there are a lot of people employed. So there's a two-part obstacle in the fossil fuel industry. There's kind of the corporations and the shareholders and the big profits they make from oil and so on, you know, when the prices of oil are right. And then there are the people who work there. I mean, we've seen this in the coal industry that some of the resistance to transition out of coal came out of the communities where it is the mainstay of people's mm-hmm. livelihoods, where they put bread and butter on their table and have a good job, even though they know it's dangerous and, you know, there are accidents and people lose their lives. It is the way they make, for the most part, a pretty good living. And so, you know, you can't ask people to give up a good living. And so there's been resistance. For that, I think what is called a just transition is needed. I think you need to make a provision to create jobs in those communities that are good jobs, that are living wage jobs, that are jobs that have comparable income. You can't just say jobs. It can't be $8 and $10 an hour to replace jobs that are, $40 and $50 an hour, or even $30 an hour. So I think that, and there are places, the states, that are creating just transition plans, that are making provisions for workers. And, some of this can be seen just in the marketplace in Texas with the ups and downs of oil. It so happens that most of the states that are heavy in the fossil fuel industry have very rich renewable energy resources. Mm-hmm. Texas is a very good example. Oklahoma, very good. Wyoming alone has wind resources that are equal to or greater than all the nuclear power produced in the United States. Just really? Wyoming alone, yes. And North Dakota and South Dakota have more. Of course, North Dakota is a big oil state. So we need to work with the states and the workers and the unions.
In Texas, too, with the wind.
Texas is big on wind and solar. New Mexico, California. California, many people may not know, is one of the leading oil-producing states. I mean, mm-hmm. If you go to Los Angeles, you see all the,
right.
Getting oil out of the ground. And so we need to plan this transition to be fair with workers, not after their industries have collapsed, as happened with coal. We need to be proactive in making these communities vibrant, making sure that the libraries and so on, our fire departments that are being funded through fossil fuel related taxes and royalties, mm-hmm. don't fall apart when the fossil fuel, are phased out. We need to think about things like what's going to replace petroleum taxes that are now used to maintain the roads and highways. Well, you're getting rid of petroleum. So there's a lot of attention to be paid in the weeds, and the interests in the jobs and businesses reside in those weeds because we're such a specialized society. And in the planning for the transition, we need to get down in the weeds. We need to go to the communities. We need to have community input. And it's going to happen primarily at the state level. I would say California is doing a pretty good job. I think in the electricity sector, Texas has done a very good job. They're ideologically fairly different states. Mm-hmm. But actually, the most wind energy in the United States is right. in Texas by far. Mm-hmm. They were lagging in solar energy, but now they seem determined to catch up. And the economic transition, one example is the publicly owned municipal utility in San Antonio that wanted to build a nuclear power plant. They spent $400 million planning it. I was helping the community there, and I said, really, you're down an expensive course. Don't do this. The project fell apart, like most of the so-called nuclear renaissance. And they decided to become an example of a renewable energy utility. They are now the CPS Energy is now one of the leading municipal utilities in a transition to renewable energy. Very good. They've done a great job. Their city council has done a great job. Actually, Mr. Castro was a presidential candidate, was mayor of San Antonio at the time that I was kind of trying to nudge them on a better course.
Oh, that's great work. Congratulations.
That's good. Yeah. Well, it's to the people who listen.
Right. And, we know we can get models in enlightened states like my home state of Massachusetts, and those are important. And it's also very important to get them in states like Texas. So good for you for doing that.
The most renewable energy, the highest percentage of renewable electricity in the United States relative to its consumption. Can you take a guess?
The highest percentage of renewable related to its consumption. Texas?
No.
Who?
Iowa.
Iowa, the biofuels.
Not biofuels.
Not biofuels.
Electricity. This is wind electricity.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's so profitable to generate wind electricity. They just have all these turbines and they export electricity to the rest of the rest of the
Wow.
Midwest.
And what do you think made Iowa take the lead on renewables?
Somebody over there, Warren Buffett, I think, who owns one of the utilities there, realized they could make a lot of money doing it. And this is sort of an example of, you know, so there are vested interests now in the renewable energy industry. They're a little bit shy of taking on the fossil fuel folks who are very powerful. They don't want to, you know, fight in the energy industry, but I don't think they should be shy. I think we need to have some of the business on our side for this energy transition. The consuming businesses should be on our side. It can be cheaper. You know, a lot of the larger sort of technology companies buy renewable energy. They announce these wonderful goals. We're going to be 100% carbon neutral. They're doing it because when they buy solar and wind energy, they get electricity cheaper than they're buying.
Wow. So we have had, you know, some incredible political pressure brought to bear, the upwelling of the Sunrise Movement and this whole coalescing around the concept of the Green New Deal, that we're going to use this need for a transition to renewable energy and a whole green economy and use it as a chance to address some of the social inequities of the fossil fuel economy that we've had, to make sure that everybody's included in the new green economy, which of course we want to do. Anybody who was left out and left behind in the old dirty fossil fuel economy has an opportunity now to be included in the new green economy. So it's a great concept. What do you think of the Green New Deal, and what do you think of the groups that are working? Like, what groups do you think our listeners should be gravitating to help support?
The Sunrise Movement is great. I think they're wonderful young people. I think what they say, you know, is an existential truth. They're young people, you know, they're teenagers in their 20s, their 30s. They have decades ahead of them, and these decades can be very disastrous if we don't take action. So they're really fighting for their right to life, or at least a right to a decent, secure life, which they cannot have unless we address this problem. Sunrise Movement, very good. The Green New Deal is great in concept, but I think everybody's got their own version of the Green New Deal. And I think what I would suggest is sometimes the versions are what I would call a Planet America version, as if the climate problem is an American problem alone. It is a global problem, and, you know, the United States is, you know, should re-enter the Paris Agreement, is going to leave this year. But we need to set targets in this country in a way that will not cause, say, lithium prices to skyrocket. Mm-hmm. If lithium prices skyrocket and we say every car on the road should convert to electric, not just new cars in the next 10 years, lithium prices will skyrocket. And we will also have older battery technology prematurely. And then the poorer countries will have a harder time making a transition. So we have to think in a global context. We have to think, how is the United States going to fulfill its part of the responsibility, not only as the largest cumulative emitter of greenhouse gases, but as a part of the global community to fulfill its part of that pledge, $100 billion a year from the wealthier countries to the less wealthy countries that are developing to make the same transition. And it can't be like you take care of, you know, you reduce your carbon emissions and I can go on emitting what is called offsets. That's no longer acceptable. Mm-hmm. So we have to, you know, we think there's a problem with coal miners here, and there is, you know, so many lost their livelihoods without good replacement. There's an even bigger problem with coal miners in China and India. There are millions of coal miners. Here, there are less than 100,000. And so we need to worry about that. So I think the Green New Deal concept is excellent. I would suggest that the document I submitted to Congress, and I hope you'll link to it, it's on our website at the very top on the homepage, could be a good technical framework for the Green New Deal. Now, you know, the transportation can be accelerated. It needs to be fleshed out. You know, I did it in a couple of days because the deadline was very soon after I realized I could submit this. So it does need to be fleshed out. I'm available at no charge to help the Green New Deal folks or people in Congress to flesh out technically what the Green New Deal should look like. I really would love to do that. You know, it's been 50 years of work. And this is the moment to, you know, in the 70s, my work became very much in the center of public policy as part of the Energy Policy Project of the Ford Foundation, led by Dave Freeman, who passed away last month, unfortunately. He was a great, great leader in energy. I think we can take inspiration from what he did in the 70s and make an even bigger revolution now. It can be done, but the Green New Deal needs to have goals that are fast and that pay attention to equity. And you know, the words are there in the Green New Deal. I think the framework of the Green New Deal is excellent. We need to make sure that the bills of low-income households remain an affordable part of their income. 6% is the acceptable number. That should be part of the Green New Deal. I think it's in my document that bills of low-income households should not exceed
6%. Yes, it is.
We should make public transportation free, especially now. And, you know, those revenues have to come from somewhere. And I think the reduction of inequalities is an admirable part of the Green New Deal. So the framework of the Green New Deal and the large vision is very important. I think technical fine tuning is needed. And I try to provide that with the document I wrote for the committee in Congress, in the House.
Yeah. That's really great. And you're a wonderful advisor to members of Congress, to state legislators. Let's add president to that list. Hopefully we'll elect a new president who is not a climate denier and who will take lead here.
Give me a call. You know, they can give me a call. I'm available. It doesn't have to wait. It doesn't have to wait for the election.
No, exactly. And yeah. Just so you know, and our listeners, that's my intention over the next 4 months is to use this radio show as an opportunity to showcase some of the leading thinkers and activists who have solutions to our major challenges in our country that could hopefully inform a new administration and a new Congress. And we're going to kind of make this as easy as possible as we can when we get new leadership in to just hit the ground running with what needs to be done.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I have been part of a very tiny minority that said, let's do things differently and it's possible. And big things came out of it. You know, I did the first efficiency assessment of the US economy in 1971, 2 years before the first energy crisis. That's how I wound up working for Dave Freeman. He was thinking the same thing when he worked in the White House at the same time. And, you know, our report became the foundation of President Carter's energy policy. The National Renewable Energy Lab, you know, was recreated from there. The standards of efficiency for cars, what we call the CAFE standards, came from there. The regulation that allows us to feed renewable electricity into the grid, because grids were closed to everybody except utilities. Only utility electrons were allowed on the wire. That's no longer true as a result of a 1978 law, and that the recommendation for that law came from our work. And the big thing was that the technical work was sitting there, but there were two things that were important to making it happen. Dave Freeman, who said, I am going to make this happen, he went to the Senate and worked over there and so on, and President Carter said, this is going to be my, not in those words, but right. Basically he said, this book is going to guide my energy policy. And so Dave Freeman and President Carter, most of all President Carter in a way, was able to make it happen. Unfortunately, all that momentum was largely stopped, but still not. I mean, we're still living with the benefits of that, you know, in terms of much more efficient cars. Cars were 10, 12 miles a gallon in 1970.
Well, we just have a 1 minute left here, but before you go, I just wanted to give you a chance to tell our listeners, like, what are quickly the three most important things our listeners could do to help with this whole shift to renewable energy, a green economy?
Well, I think individual actions are said not to amount to much, but I do think that Gandhi G was right when he said, be the change. So it's hard to advocate, change when you're not doing things yourself. I think, and it's economical to fix up your house to some extent, pressure landlords, organize for that. But most of all, you have to organize for public policy change. You have to have the right people in office. You have to, so it's not a partisan thing. As we've said, in Iowa and Texas and so on, people are doing very good things. And businesses, on a bipartisan stage are doing things. I think we have to hold business more accountable, not only government more accountable for this transition. So basically, we have to put an infrastructure into place that will allow the policy and technical transition to happen. And we also have to pay much, much more attention to the equity of the transition for fossil fuel workers and for low-income households. I think those are absolutely essential, and we can do it. I've outlined it, and I actually wrote a whole book on energy equity for Maryland.
Right. And speaking of your book, you've got a couple of your books up on your website. So, listeners, to get more information, you can go to Dr. Markajani's website. It's IEER.org. It stands for the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research.org. And those books are up there for free to go, and you can download them, read them, as well as your testimony to Congress from October. It's all up there free. So please, listeners, go check out IEER.org and learn more information and keep current with what's up. So that's all the time we have. Dr. Arjun Makhijani, thank you so much for being with us today and for your world-saving work.
A pleasure to connect with you again.
Something